Great. Well, welcome everybody. You have joined Estate Planning Basics panel discussion for today, and I'm so excited that you have decided to take your first step towards putting your own estate plan together, should anything happen to you. I'm Sonia Stigler, and I developed this event and discussion to help you get started with your estate planning, no matter what your situation. So whether you just become a new homeowner, or you have minor children, or whether you have a will and haven't even looked at it in years, I want you to have peace of mind when it comes to putting your estate plan in place. And I want to thank our panelists for joining me, and I'll do a more specific intro in just a minute. I want to thank Debbie Moritz Farr. She's in California. I want to thank Autumn Dimitrovich. She's in Kentucky. And Yana Feldman, who's in New York. And I specifically wanted to seek out women to help women. Doesn't mean that I can't help men too, but I wanted to specifically elevate women in their businesses. So I want to let you know that I put that together specifically. So just as a disclaimer, I want to make sure you know that no one's going to be giving legal advice specific to any situation or personal situation today. So if you want to follow up with anyone, I'll share everyone's contact information with you so that you can follow up directly. I want to put this whole discussion in context for you. As part of my business, Practigal, for those who haven't met me before, I help people get to the next level. And so you can see that in the books that I've written so far, Welcome to the Next Level and What's Next for My Career. And the topic we're going to cover today on estate planning will make an appearance in the third book in the series, Set Yourself Up for Success. And it's based on one of the tips that I share in there or will be sharing in there, which is to advocate for yourself. So put those things in place that help you. And sometimes helping my clients get to that next level requires me to bring in outside experts, things that I don't know or care to know about. And so estate planning is one of those, which is a story I share in the second book of What's Next for My Career, when I actually looked into trusted estates as a possible area, decided it's not for me. So estate planning usually comes up when things go wrong. and it did for me recently. First, I had a close friend whose husband died unexpectedly. And he carried his documents around with him in his briefcase, unsigned. So had to help her through that process. And then second, this is a little closer to home. My first husband, Greg, died recently. And thankfully, he had his basic documents in place because one of the stipulations when we got divorced was actually redoing all our trusts and wills and everything. So I just want to let you know, my life's purpose is to help inspire other people to take action, not just simply inspire you and have you go off and do nothing. So I'm not like Tony Robbins. I definitely want you to take action after today. So that's why I put these series together. And hopefully what we discuss today will give you more specific direction to put your own estate documents in place. Let's get started with the agenda. Pretty simple. We're going to chat about the basics. I've got subject matters to introduce you to. We have a little bit about my story. I'll tell you a little bit more details. And then we're going to actually cover the basics. Where to start, what are the main documents to begin with, and then we'll talk a little bit about probate and whether you want to go through that or not, or avoid it, and what the tactics might be to do that. We'll talk about trusts and when it makes sense to put those in place, and then we'll talk about other considerations to take into account. So the outcomes for today, I just want you to be clear about your wishes and desires and if something should happen to you, what you want to happen subsequently. And I want you to start educating yourself and be less fearful around this topic and to be able to start those conversations that may be difficult or uncomfortable. And last, I'm going to introduce you to subject matter experts so that you can get the right information to help you and put these documents in place for you. And bonus, if you stay to the end, I have a free gift for everyone, and it's not legal advice. So just want you to know that. So I'm going to stop sharing and let's introduce our experts. I'm going to start with Deb. She's the one I've known the longest. So let's see. Debbie, gosh, I've known Debbie since we went to Berkeley together. So we were sorority sisters, and I've known her, I don't know, more than half my life. She joined Turner, Hewitt, Adams & Farr in 2008, and she's had over 3 decades of legal experience, starting as a deputy district attorney for Alameda County and as a medical malpractice defense attorney and in-house counsel for Providian Bank. So she's got a good, well-rounded experience with firms and corporations and the government. And so prior to joining the firm, she was a sole practitioner in estate planning. And her expertise includes jury and court trials, in addition to all aspects of estate planning, including wills, trusts, and probates. So everything we're going to be chatting about today. She graduated from McGeorge School of Law. And of course, I already said Berkeley. She and her husband raised 2 daughters. And hopefully we'll hear more about those. And she and her husband live in Martinez, and she's active in her community, including sitting on the board of conservatorship, guardian, probate, and trust section of the Contra Costa County Bar Association. And she's a member of the trust and estate section and taxation section of the California State Bar. So Debbie, welcome.
Thank you.
And full disclosure, she did our documents in California. So let's go to Autumn. So Autumn Dimitrovich, she graduated from the University of Kentucky College of Law in May of 2008, and she's licensed attorney in Kentucky. She spent the first 8 years of her legal career as a felony prosecutor for the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And in 2016, she switched gears to become a right-of-way agent for a public utility. And in August of 2019, she started a private law practice on the side, focusing on estate planning and probate. And she'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through the discussion today. Thank you for joining, Autumn. And last but not least, Yana Feldman. She's the owner of Yana Feldman and Associates, also known as New York Legacy Lawyers. And her firm focuses on holistic and creative client-centered planning with the goal of creating not only a financial legacy, but also one of personal values and non-monetary assets, with an emphasis on ensuring clients' dignity and independence as they age. And her goals include educating on the importance of estate and elder law planning, working with the sandwich generation of men and women raising children while caring for aging parents and creating a modern law firm. And she earned her degree in anthropology in 99 from the University of Chicago and graduated from Tulane Law School in New Orleans in 2002. Her practice includes estate and tax planning, business succession planning, elder law, and this is important, Medicaid planning, guardianship, trust and estate administration and litigation. She's fluent in Russian and lives in Brooklyn with her architect husband and their twin daughters. So we have a bang up group of women lawyers to help educate us on this topic. So I'll just tell you a little bit about my story. As a lawyer, you know you should put wills and trusts and other things in place, but I didn't do it. Didn't do it. Finally had my second kid, figured, oh, we better do something. So put wills and a trust in place with my first husband and left it in place for 24 years that we were married and didn't really look at it. Third kid wasn't included, not fatal mistake or anything, but wasn't included. And when we got divorced, I had to put other documents in place because that's one of the things we negotiated to just redo everything when we divided things. So got new documents put into place, totally good. And then I got remarried. So did them for a third time. And what we've done this time is we work with a financial planner, we work with the estate planning team, and we have integrated discussions about what we want to happen on both of those fronts. So now we pay attention to it. Now we review it pretty regularly. We actually have a plan of what to do and review it probably quarterly, not the wills and trusts, but the financial plan as well. But these documents get reviewed as part of that larger plan. So it's not a one and done and forget it. So let's talk about the basics. And maybe Autumn, if you want to just talk about what you go over with your clients when you're talking about the basic documents, because I thought you had a really great approach.
Thank you. So just a little kind of background, as Sonia mentioned, I have a private practice on the side. I still have a day job working for a public utility. That's my 9 to 5. So I don't, I can be pretty selective about the clients that I take on. I don't have to really hustle to keep business coming in because I don't want to get overwhelmed. But what I've kind of found just through happenstance is that the clients getting referred to me are in their 30s, married, have a couple of young kids, and, you know, not a ton of assets, but some, you know, maybe some retirement, some life insurance, a mortgage, that sort of thing. So that's kind of where my practice is kind of focused, because there's really a gap in the market here in Lexington, Kentucky, of people who can do estate planning and know what they're doing, but do it affordably. And for people who don't really need something terribly complicated. So what I tell my clients is there are really kind of four pillars of a basic estate plan. One is your durable power of attorney, which covers any kind of financial or a kind of life administrative duties if you are unable to do them for yourself. The healthcare power of attorney or healthcare surrogate is the same thing, but for medical decisions and speaking to your doctors. The advanced directive or the living will is more about end of life decisions and also kind of funeral, burial, cremation, those sorts of plans. And then finally, the last will and testament, which everybody is familiar with. Those are really the four things. And I think you can do those pretty easily. I mean, there are a lot of other things you could add in, trusts, you know, different kinds of special trusts, all these things, but those are the four basics. And I really hope that people get more comfortable calling up attorneys and saying, look, I know that I need these four things. What do you charge? You know, what's your process? There's lots of information online about like what these things specify and what kind of things that you have to think about. But, you know, call attorneys and just say, you know, I need to do an estate plan. What are the things I need to think about? What should I talk to my spouse about? What kind of decisions do we need to make before we, you know, commit to this process? So I try to tell my clients just, you know, we're going to start with the basics. We'll work through step by step. It's not overwhelming. It can be as complicated as you want, but it can be very simple if that's really just all you need for your situation.
Yeah, I know you have a little bit different interpretation of wills, and let's hear you.
So I don't like wills, you know. I draft them, you know, I certainly, all of my clients end up with some form of will. But for most of my clients, I encourage them to use a trust-based plan. There's certainly exceptions, but in New York, probate is a little bit onerous, even when everyone gets along. And I've been practicing long enough that, you know, I've had to probate some of the wills that I've created. And, you know, I'm happy to say that, you know, everything was fine and how I drafted them, et cetera. And even in those circumstances where the documents were drafted properly and everyone's cooperative, it's fairly onerous. It takes time, it takes money. If there's a minor child involved, the court will appoint a guardian ad litem, you know, which costs several thousand dollars. The filing fees are high, etc. So I encourage most of my clients to use a trust-based plan over a will-based plan. And I know that's very different in various states. I think California trust-based plans are very popular. I know in other states, people are like, oh no, probate's a breeze. It's, you know, not a problem. So that's really going to depend. What I tell my clients is, if you have assets in more than one state, you might want to consider using a trust. Mm-hmm. If you have beneficiaries who are minors or have special needs, you know, maybe over 18, but have special needs, you might want to consider using a trust. If you are trying to disinherit people, you know, you might want to consider using a trust, because in New York, when you probate a will, you basically have to send an invitation in the mail to anyone who would take, if there were no will, giving them notice and offering them an opportunity to contest that will. So, you know, those are reasons why I'm not a huge fan of trusts.
So I'm going to talk about special needs and trust more in a bit, but I do want to just focus on something you said in terms of what would happen if people didn't have a will in place. So no trust, no will. Let's say unmarried professional woman in her 50s owns a house. What happens then? So no will in place. What happens then?
So I missed my opportunity to use one of my best lines, which is, if, you know, does anyone in this group have a will? And then a few people raise their hands and most people kind of look down at their shoes. And then I say, no, don't worry. Everyone in this room has a will. The problem is only some of you have chosen the terms of your will, and the rest of you are accepting the terms that the state has chosen for everybody.
So and that varies state, across all the states.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, in New York, and this one is really shocking for people. In New York, if you're married and you have children, your estate is roughly divided in half between your spouse and your kids. And it doesn't matter how old your kids are. It doesn't matter if they're from the marriage, you know, to your spouse or from another, you know, with another partner. And that's really shocking for people, because most people think, well, if I'm married, everything should just go to my spouse and they'll take care of my children. So I don't know what, you know, the other states that you ladies practice in, what the intestacy statute is there. I know some states are different. But it's really easy. Just type your state intestacy and it'll come right up.
Yeah. So if you want the state deciding for you, don't do a thing. But if you don't want whatever the state's going to do, you may or may not know what that is. Definitely put a will of some kind in place. Let's see. Deb, I would like you just, before we leave, like what the four basic documents are and go to like how, what probate is and avoiding it, can you just break it down for me a little more detail about the four documents that were mentioned? So let's start with the last will and testament.
Well, I think I was excited to hear Autumn say the four, you know, the four pillars of an estate plan. And then she went off and said things that don't resonate in California. So I was like, oh, and so then I heard Yana and I'm like, oh, well, we, California and New York have some similarities. I too break it down for new clients, the four main pillars of an estate plan in the state of California. If you're gonna put together a plan for yourself, we start off with what's called the Advanced Healthcare Directive. And in California, our Advanced Healthcare Directive, most of them encapsulate a few of the documents, three of the documents that Autumn was talking about. So it includes end of life decisions. It also includes access to medical records. And it includes decisions about healthcare when you can't make it. So it's all encompassed into one document. Used to be traditionally called Power of Attorney for Healthcare here in California, but we have changed it to Advanced Healthcare Directive.
So that came into play for me personally when Greg died and Jasper was the designated person. So our oldest son, and he was 22. So you want your 22-year-old making those life, like end of life decisions for you.
Right.
Yeah. So it matters that you put on those documents.
It does matter. It matters that the person, they may not have the same viewpoint about end of life. But it, most importantly, you select somebody who will honor your wishes and you've communicated, because there's so much in that document or there's so much not in that document that are personal belief systems to you of how you value your life and when it no longer has meaning. And I always tell people it's like a funnel. At the beginning, you say, I don't want to be held on machines. And then it gets more and more detailed and detailed and detailed. And it comes down to, the very end where you're very detailed about it. And also, there's also, I think it's called a dementia or a, gosh, I'm trying to think, I had somebody look this up, but it's specifically for when you get dementia or Alzheimer's. There's a specific, and it came from New York, I think, Yana. I did a Google search and it was specifically for dementia, healthcare directive. And somebody had put it together, because I had somebody who was very concerned about that in one of the places, someplace in New York, but that's a side note. But you can put all that into your healthcare directive so that the agent or agents, you can select more than one person. You have to be very careful about that. But that they are not really making the decision, they're following your wishes that are articulated in that. Otherwise, if you show up in a car accident to the hospital and don't have an advanced healthcare directive, they're not going to let certain people into the room. They're not, especially during COVID.
Not the ex-wife either.
Yeah. They won't let you in. They will not let you make decisions. You can't get second opinions when your loved one is there incapacitated. There are certain ways we can get around it, but I usually think that that's the first line of defense that usually comes up as an estate planner and probate lawyer. It's usually that call. Somebody's gone down for the count. I need a power of attorney for my mom. And I'm like, okay, are we talking body or money? Then they usually say she fell and she can't get up and she's getting a hip replacement and she has dementia. And I'm okay. That's an advanced healthcare directive. So that's usually the first document. The second one I think all of us had in place was that durable power of attorney for financial matters. That really is the tool that gets the designated person access to anything that is not in a living trust in California. So the living trust is a separate document, and those terms in that document will determine who gets access to those assets that are physically titled in the name of the trust. So the Farr Family Trust, that document says who the next person can get into my accounts and sell my house and do all of that. To get to my IRA, if I'm incapacitated, or get to my cable bill or pay my phone or change my phone plan, if I'm incapacitated, that's going to be the durable power of attorney for financial matters, which, by the way, for everybody, is in California, it's only legal and active while you're alive. When you die, the power of attorney dies with you. So you can't call up or go to the bank and say, mom died yesterday, I want to use her power of attorney to clean out her account. No, they don't, that's totally in conflict. So at that point, when she's dead, the power of attorney dies, and then you're stuck with the legal solutions that are available at that point. And then we have a trust, and everybody who has a living trust has a power of attorney. I'm sorry, everybody who has a trust has a what we call a pour over will in California. It's like a safety net that sits right below your trust, and it sometimes literally catches things that you should have put in your trust, but you just got lazy and didn't change the title. So your investment account or your checking account or something, the will catches it and puts it in the trust. Our goal in California is we don't ever want to have to use that will, because the cost of probate in the state of California is exorbitant. And it takes a really long time. Our courts are backlogged. I don't usually have a problem getting somebody appointed as an executor, but to close an estate in the state of California, you know, it's 18 months, 2 years sometimes. So there's just not a lot of room in the probate court for these types of things. So those are
here. I'm going to pop in and just say, by contrast, in Kentucky, it is extremely cheap to file for probate, and it moves extremely quickly. And it's just very interesting how that varies from state to state.
Yeah, and I think one of the consequences of California probate, and this is just from my personal experience, I think one of the things in California that we're advised to do is put everything in a trust, change the title to your car and your house and whatever else you're going to put in that trust, so that you don't ever have to go through probate. So now that that's reared its ugly head, let's just move on to that as a topic. Why is probate a dirty word? Well, we've heard from Deb in California and Autumn in Kentucky that we have different experiences in terms of time and speed and effort and money it takes to go through probate. So Deb, maybe start there. And then Yana, I'll let you speak to New York area, and then Autumn for Kentucky. So I just want to hear how it's different and why you want to go through probate or don't want to go through probate.
Well, generally my clients don't want to go through it. I think there's been only a couple times in my career advising people, they know everybody's going to fight anyway. Then in that weird case, I'm like, let's just do a will and throw it into probate court, because we're going to end up there with the trust anyway, with everybody litigating the terms of the trust. But generally in California, let me just say, because I saw one of the questions that popped up, one of the ways to avoid probate in the state of California is if you have beneficiaries on your accounts. So the probate code speaks to all of our choices about wills, trusts, powers of attorney, healthcare directives. That code speaks to everything. And the things that are subject to the probate process, if you die and you have assets that are in your name alone, no beneficiaries, no co-owners, not in trust. That's usually what falls victim to the probate process. And it's just a legal way for us to get what you have to the people who are entitled to it, either by your will or by, as Yana said, the state of California's plan for you. The state of California is also very generous to their lawyers who do probate in that we get paid on the gross value of the assets that go through probate, not the net. So your wonderful $1 million house in California now, even though you might have a $900,000 mortgage, I get paid from the court at the end based on the $1 million value. And I get paid in gradations. So 4% on the first 100,000 of value, gross, 3% on the next 100,000 value, 2% up to $1 million, and 1% over $1 million. So it can be quite lucrative, about $22,000 on an $800,000 estate that is going through probate. And I recently had a probate, well, not recently, a couple of years ago, where the house didn't get put in the trust and there was no way for us to backdoor it into the trust. And I had IRAs of a single man, significant IRAs of a single man who had named his mother as his beneficiary. And his mother had died 10 years before him, and he never updated his beneficiaries. So all of the IRAs, A, went into the probate, and by the way, immediately got taxed because they didn't pass on to a live body. He should have updated his beneficiaries to be in line with his trust beneficiaries. And then I had the house. So, I mean, it got a little expensive and it was really difficult for the family. He had a living trust. Why are we going through probate? Well, because we had a really lovely ream of paper that had nothing in it. So it's expensive. And like so those are the costs. Oh, not only does the attorney get paid those percentages, the executor gets to dip in there for the same percentages. So, you know, we're talking 7, maybe 9% per attorney and lawyer, or attorney and executor, you know, maybe up to 18% of the gross value eats up almost all the equity that some estates have. And then the time frame is onerous. So, but I agree with Yana in that if you don't do anything and you have no will, or you have just a will and we're going to go through probate because you didn't name beneficiaries or have joint owners on things, it is an invitation to everybody who is disgruntled by your plan. Yeah. To dip Please in. Come in and argue about it. Okay.
And so Yana, so what's it like in New York with probate? Do you want to do it or not?
It's not quite as draconian as far as the attorney's fees go, but I do charge by the hour. So, you know, I would say that in a very, very normal probate where everything's fine, everyone gets along, by the time
the date,
it happens. Well, I have one right now. The gentleman left a will. Left most of his estate to his wife. He has two adult children. Everyone signed off on everyone. Super pleasant and easy to work with. It's been over a year and I haven't been able to open the estate. And the wife calls me crying. And I've called in every favor that I'm owed in the surrogate's court. And I've filed, you know, petitions of urgency because she was using this money to support his elderly mother in Italy.
Yeah.
Nothing. But in a case that is normal, between filing fees and legal fees, it will be at least, you know, $6,000 to $8,000 at a bare minimum. And that's assuming it's a very simple estate and the client does some of the lifting, you know, isn't relying on us to do every single thing in the estate administration. It can easily go up from there. And the executor commissions are, you know, I think it's 4% on the first 100 and then 3% on the next 200 and then 2%, you know, so there's a formula for that. So there is expense. Again, if you have minor children, even if there's a surviving parent and the will says, I appoint the surviving parent as the trustee for my minor children, you know, et cetera, the court will on its own appoint a guardian ad litem for those children. And the guardian's like, you know, cha-ching. I'm going to investigate. And look, there's a place for this, right? Because there are some families where the people are not trustworthy.
Can you just explain what a guardian ad litem is?
My Latin is rusty, but I think my Latin is rusty. It's just a guardian for this limited proceeding.
And it's usually minor children.
Pardon?
It's usually involving minor children.
If there's a minor or the person is under disability, so an adult with some sort of intellectual disability or someone who is incarcerated, you know, someone who can't, you know, adequately represent themselves in a legal proceeding. You know, and they do an investigation and they interview the children and they interview the other parent and they write it up and they appear in court and, you know, bam, there's at least $3,000 right there. You know, it's just sort of needless, you know, the cost difference in, and I know someone asked about, you know, fees, and I'm going to say they're really going to vary. And I have some tips about, you know, how to choose an attorney. You know, but the fees between a will-based plan and a trust-based plan isn't really that different. You do have to come up with a little bit more money in the beginning. You know, it might be a difference of $1,500 or $2,500. You know, nothing dramatic. I think the only times that I will go forward with a will-based plan was one gentleman who was very cash poor and owned an expensive piece of property, and his beneficiaries were his adult nieces that were in their 40s and financially secure. And he said, it's fine. They're going to inherit this multi-million dollar property in Brooklyn. They can worry about administrating my estate. Or in New York, we have this concept of a co-op apartment, which if anyone has dealt with, sometimes co-op apartments, you don't actually own the apartment, you own shares in a corporation, and they won't allow you to transfer that into a trust sometimes. But those are really the only times that I don't basically insist on a trust-based plan these days.
I wanted to go back to one thing you just said. I actually have a better New York question. This is a New York question. If you have a will and all bank accounts have beneficiaries on them, will you still be involved in probate?
That's a great question. And I think this actually will apply for you know, the other states as well. We have what we call probate assets and non-probate assets. So non-probate assets pass by what we call operation of law. So if you have a beneficiary on an account, your account will go to that beneficiary. If you own a property jointly with your spouse, in New York, we call it tenancy by the entirety, that will pass to your spouse. If you own a property or an account jointly with rights of survivorship, that will go to the joint owner. If it's a tenancy in common, that means that you only own part of it and your part would be controlled by a will. So you could have a will that says, I leave everything to X But if you've gone through all of your assets and named beneficiaries or have joint ownership with somebody else, X is going to be left out of the cold and you might never need to probate that will. That's why I was saying, you know, the best will is the one that we never need to use, because everything either has a beneficiary or it's in a trust. You know, there's a mechanism in place for how that asset will pass. So if that's the case, then you won't need to go through probate.
Okay.
I jump in here real quick. Just I have an ugly kind of little vignette to tell people. With beneficiary designations comes joint ownership on accounts, like Yana mentioned. So I have a case now where the mother had two children. She thought everybody got along. And so she had one child jointly on one account and the other child jointly on another account. And then she had a will that said everything 50-50. Well, when it came, and then she had a long illness and lived with one of the children. And we came to find out that when she passed away, one account with the daughter had $350,000 in it, joint ownership. So it passed to the daughter outright. It was a non-probate asset by operation of law in California. And the account with the son had $15,000 in it. And he got his 15, she got her 350. And then surprise, surprise, the sister was not gifting over 50% of that. She was not gonna make her brother whole. And they had to use the will to probate the house that went 50-50. But when we tried to, you know, make some arguments about getting that $350,000 account pulled into the probate, we were unsuccessful. And I had told the client at the beginning, that's not, it's by operation of law, joint owner gets it. Last man standing gets it all. And so you can understand what the dynamics of that family are now is not only are the two siblings never going to speak to each other, but nor are the cousins. So it's trickled down just by the mom thought that the will would control and she thought the kids would do the right thing. And lo and behold, whatever the daughter was going on in her household, I don't know how money got moved around, but it was a windfall.
So Anne's asking if the house was probated because it wasn't in a trust.
That is correct. The house was probated because it was the only assets subject to the will. All the other assets were non-probatable assets because they were jointly owned or had beneficiaries on them.
Okay. So Autumn, what's probate like in Kentucky? And do you send people through it or do you try to avoid it?
Well, I'm glad we're not in person so you can't throw things at me. in pre-COVID days, I would walk into the courthouse and file the petition with the clerk and it would be entered that day. I know. I'm sorry.
Yana's like, it's taken me a year.
And I'm in Lexington. I mean, I'm not like in a rural county where I just know everybody. In COVID times, they have a drop box and it takes 3 days to get entered. And then I get my hearing to have my executor appointed usually in about 2 weeks. So I'm sorry. And filing fees in Fayette County are $83.
We're on a different scale.
I know it's like hearing that. I'm not going to tell you any numbers about what I charge because we are obviously operating in completely different areas, but it's not anything like New York and California here. So probate's very easy. Probate's very cheap. In one county that I'm dealing with, like we don't even go to court or have Zoom. Like it's all just done by paperwork. I've never been in front of the judge. It's not complicated. You file your paperwork, everything goes through. 6 months later, after the creditor claim period has expired, you know, you file your final inventory and ask to close it up and they say, fine. Now this is assuming that everything is, this is a smooth case. Now I just got signed on to a case yesterday that is not going to go that way. I already know the family dynamics will not. But you know, if you do have just, I have a case where this sweet old lady died, she has one daughter and that's it. And her will says everything goes to the daughter, daughter's the executor. And that's easy. I mean, there's just not really much to do. So, We do also have in Kentucky that, you know, executors and the attorneys can make up to a percentage of the gross estate. I do a flat fee, mostly because I don't want to deal with an escrow account. I do a non-refundable retainer, and then everything else is paid at the end. But, you know, other attorneys that do this more kind of for a full-time basis will do, they take the percentage of the estate, and that can, I forget what the number is. Maybe 5%. I don't know if we have a gradation, but that's similar to California, New York.
I do want to say that this area of law varies on a state-by-state basis. And you can see just from Kentucky, New York, and California how widely it varies. So I know we were asked a question of, is it the same in North Carolina? And I don't know the answer to that question. Anybody else? Okay. Is it the same in Pennsylvania? I don't know the answer to that. So what I've put in the chat window for everybody is a resource list of other recommended trust and estate attorneys in different locations. So take a look on that list and don't hesitate to call them and do an appointment just to explore what the hot button issues are. I know each of you, Yana, Autumn, and Deb, do consultations. Sometimes people have paid consultations, sometimes they have free consultations for that initial discussion. And I would say, make sure you take a look at that list for other attorneys in your area and start those conversations. No one's gonna bite you. No one's gonna, you know, like send you down a rabbit hole. They really truly want you to understand what you're getting into and what you need to put, what minimum documents you need to put in place.
Sonia, what's the basis for this list? Do they know you, or what's the basis for who's on it?
The basis for the list is I belong to a couple groups of attorneys. One is Mother's Esquire and one is Badass Attorney Moms. And there are thousands of women in there, and I ask for recommendations of trust and estate attorneys in these different areas. And this is the group that was recommended to me. And the people sitting here were recommended more than once. So that's why we started this discussion. We'll probably have more discussions on this topic because it's so important, but this is where I wanted to start today with the basics. I do want to go on and talk about trust and when it makes sense and when it doesn't make sense. I think you heard Deb say loud and clear, it matters in California to put everything in trust so you can avoid probate. Or have beneficiaries designated on the accounts, whether it's, you know, your 401k or whatever kind of account insurance has beneficiaries. And I put a tip in the chat box to say, make sure you check your beneficiaries. Greg did not have beneficiaries designated on his 503b plan from SRI where he was working when I met him. So he had never changed that in the 25 years we were together, not even to my name. So, that is, who knows what's happening with that right now, because I'm not the executor and I don't have to step in it. So, but I want to talk about trust, and we'll just have each of you talk about what it means in your state and whether you, what considerations are there to put one in place, like real property or children or special needs children, like tell me where those are. So Autumn, why don't you start? Because hopefully it'll be the simpler one of all of them. Then we'll go to New York and California, because I think we're just going to go more complex as we go.
Yeah, Kentucky's really easy. We're chill about all this stuff. So for trust, what I tell my clients is that please correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that trusts really started getting popular 20, 30 years ago when the federal estate tax limit was much, much lower. Now it's 11.5 million. None of my clients will ever have to worry about that. I will never have to worry about that. So, you know,
to worry about that.
Well, exactly. We all do, but I'm never going to have to worry about paying federal state tax. So, you know, if you're not dealing with huge amounts of sums of money and you need to deal with that for tax, then you have to look at other reasons. So special needs trusts and ABLE accounts, if you have a child with a disability or an adult child with a disability, absolutely. You have to have that because otherwise, and I don't know if we're going to get into this later, but just quickly, a special needs trust, an ABLE account is a different version of that, but basically any benefits that your child is getting from the government, they can be jeopardized if that child receives money, inherits money. So a special needs trust can protect, can allow for a child to inherit while still protecting their benefits from the government, depending on how you structure it and how, you know, what the benefits are and that sort of thing. So if you have a child with special needs, a special needs trust is definitely something you need to talk about. When you're talking about someone looking at maybe going into a nursing home, you want to look at asset protection, and I'll let others talk about that because I don't really do much of that. And then there are lots of other things. I think you've got listed charitable giving. The biggest thing that I've seen people ask about is, so I'm sure it's every, like in everywhere, but Kentucky, if you pass away, your case gets probated, your will becomes public. It gets, you know, essentially published. It's recorded in the county clerk's office. Anyone can walk in and look at it. And if privacy is a concern, if you just don't want people knowing your business, then a trust is a way to hide that. And I don't mean that in a nefarious way, but just, you know, if you want to determine, exactly, it's private. You want to determine how your assets get passed on, and you don't think that the world needs to know that, and that's a valid concern. So trust is the way that you avoid that. But I don't really do trusts. It's just my clients aren't, I mean, I always talk to them about them, and I explain what they are and what their benefits are. And I research them and give them advice and options, but I've not had one take me up on it yet. I do have one that might be doing a special needs trust. We're figuring that out, but my clients don't feel like they need a trust. So they're fine to go through probate. Now that may change as they get a little older and they acquire more assets, their life situation changes. But right now, you know, you got two teachers who are 30 and like they make, you know, $60,000 between the two of them, and they have a house that's mortgaged to the hilt, and they've got two. I mean, that they're not concerned with the trust. They're concerned with who's going to take care of their children if something happens to them, and what happens to the money for the kids. So, yeah. And I will also throw in, not to get too deep in the weeds, but with the wills that I do, a testamentary trust is always part of that because the children, minor children, cannot inherit outright. So you're going to set up a trust at some point. But it's like, do you want to pay and do it now and then like figure out what, how you're going to fund it, how you put assets into it, or do you wait and let the executor do it as part of the estate if it becomes necessary? So.
Got it. Okay, Yana, let's hear about New York.
Okay, so like I said before, I do a lot of trusts and different ones. You know, the most basic one that I do is the revocable trust or the living trust. And, you know, that is what I call a probate avoidance trust. That's really the main focus of that. Now, the current exemption amount, the amount of assets that can be passed along without estate taxes, we know at the federal limit, it's currently very, very high. And in New York, it's around 6 million, which is also fairly high. However, I practice in New York City, where real estate can be incredibly expensive. And I'm in Brooklyn and I have a lot of clients who I would say are, you know, working people or, you know, retired working people, bus driver, nurse's aide, you know, things like that. They bought a home for $30,000 and it's now worth $3 million. You know, I don't know if Deborah and Autumn, you know, have been discussing this with their colleagues, but I anticipate the estate tax exemption amount to go down and potentially quite dramatically, to the point where, you know, taxes are going to be more of a concern, especially on the federal level. We have something called portability, where if one spouse passes away and doesn't use their exemption, it's portable to the surviving spouse. New York does not have that provision. It's not the end of the world. We just have to put put some language in the estate planning documents that's going to allow us to, make sure that the surviving spouse, you know, that the family is a unit if they're married, you know, can utilize both of the exemptions. So that's something that can be incorporated in a revocable trust plan as well. Supplemental needs trusts or special needs trusts, like Autumn mentioned, of course, that's very important if there's someone who has special needs. We also sometimes, and of course, trust for minors, and in my personal estate plan, assets stay in trust until 45, until my children have any direct access to them. I'm very lucky in that I have a very large family of blood and friends that I have put, you know, lots of permutations of who will be trustees for my children. And I know they share my values, and the money will be used for them until they're 45. But until they're 45, I don't want them to have a say in, you know, demanding that money.
Can I just butt in here for a second? We got smarter with each kid. So we started a brokerage account with each kid, and the first one got it at 18. Well, he's the one that spends it all. The next two, we got smarter and it was 25. And those two don't spend any money. They're not 25 yet either. But it just goes to show you all three raised the same philosophy and completely different spending habits. So word to the wise.
You never know, right? You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, one of the things we had discussed was, why would we want them to have the money? Like if they weren't, let's say 45, when would we want them to have money? We wanted money for college. We wanted money to be able to buy a house. So we put some ages in there. So between I think at 21, you could get, I think it was 25% of it. And then the rest of it, you would get at 30. So maybe when you wanted to buy a house. So we kind of thought through, when would we want the kids to have the money if it ended up in trust, because we met our demise, you know, sometime before then. So that was one thing we actually talked about and then put in the document.
You know, that's absolutely right. And, you know, and the nice thing about that is that you have flexibility. You know, I chose to say no. They can't demand a distribution until they're 45, but I encourage my trustee to, you know, spend, you know, for buying a home, for starting a business, for education, obviously, you know, et cetera. Yeah. And this is something that's very customizable that you can speak to your attorney about and make that decision. Something else that I do, that I did for my family, and a lot of clients are choosing this, is lifetime trusts for their children. So the assets will always stay in trust, but at a certain age, the child becomes a trustee, and the child has the ability to change the co-trustee, because maybe, you know, mom, you know, Uncle David is getting older and, you know, they want someone younger. The purpose of that is asset protection for the children, because the asset has never gone into their name. It's going to provide, that's the best kind of asset protection that we can provide for our children. And then the last thing I want to mention is, if someone is what we call a high net worth person, where they're really worried about estate taxes, there's a whole barrage of other trusts that we can talk about that I will skip for now. But something that I do a lot of, because my practice involves elder law, is what I call a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust.
Yeah.
And not all states recognize them. I know, for example, Minnesota does not recognize them. But in most states, as folks are approaching retirement age, as they're thinking about how they would fund long-term care, it's a really good idea to speak with an elder law attorney specifically. And something that I did for both my parents and my in-laws is we created these Medicaid Asset Protection Trusts. And they didn't divest themselves of all of their assets, but they put their homes into these trusts. It doesn't change their lifestyle. And for many people, their home is their largest asset.
Yeah.
You know,
we're going to do a whole session on elder care in a month or two, probably, I don't know, July-ish, to talk about that specifically, because that keeps coming up in terms of the sandwich generation. I've got to take care of my teens, and now I got to take care of my parents, and one spouse is now in home care, or, you know, what do we do to protect it and get the most use out of the benefits? We don't want to lose benefits, you know, because we didn't do something right. So we'll do a whole
Just, you know, these are, you know, some types of trusts. And then, you know, you get really fancy and, you know, you have trusts that are designed more around tax planning and asset protection planning, where we really need to work with tax advisors and, you know, et cetera. But those are kind of what I think of my basic trusts.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that appealed to us about doing a trust was when the estate tax was a lot lower, exemption was a lot lower. And so now it's higher. California has a higher one. So when we moved to Washington, Deb was like, you have to go see a Washington estate planning attorney because the numbers are different. And yes, they are different. It was much closer to what we have saved. So it was concerning. So that was a wake up call. The other thing we run into and see, and I've seen this on a firsthand basis, is that people go to an attorney, get the trust done, and then they don't actually put their assets in the trust name. So they don't go to the DMV to switch the name of the car. They don't go to the county and change the title of the house. They don't put whatever other assets you have are going into the trust, bank account, whatever it is. They don't actually do the work to fund the trust. And so, Deb, I think you have a lot to say on that topic.
Yes. Trusts in California. So I saw a lot of the questions while Yana and Autumn were speaking. The estate tax, as they both attorneys said, the current exemption is $11 million. In California, there is no estate tax. However, Oregon, Washington, it sounds like New York, each of these other states may or may not also have an additional estate tax. So you may not be worth $11 million, but you may be worth with your home and your, and when we talk about a taxable estate, we're talking about everything you have, not just what's in a trust. Yeah. So it's your retirement. It's the life insurance that's paying out to your spouse when you die, it's counted as part of your estate. So if you exceed, for example, is it Oregon or Washington that has $1 million estate tax credit? That, and anything over $1 million, if you don't plan for it, is going to get taxed by the state. So I think it's 1 million, Oregon and Washington, I get mixed up, but one
we're
of them
like has 2.35 in Washington. It's like,
yeah, something
with,
crazy.
With the house, so with the houses, we're at that number.
We're over.
Yeah. And that's not anything else. Yeah.
So the current federal estate tax credit, some of the people were asking, it's meant to sunset, and it went into play in 2025, and it's gonna sunset in December 31st of 2025, and it's gonna come back down to $5 million per person with this portability that Yana suggested. However, currently in Congress, Bernie Sanders has proposed quite a vigorous reduction further to $3.5 million for the estate tax, and upping the capital gains tax rate and getting rid of what's called a step up in cost basis when you die. So I bought my house, let's say, for $150,000. And when I die, it's worth $800,000. So that becomes the new cost basis when my children inherit. And then if they sell for $900,000, they only have a capital gain of $100,000. That step up, it currently is being proposed in Congress. For that to go away in this package. So everybody should keep their ear to the ground to see what's going to happen. I mean, that's kind of the swing that is occurring in tax law right now.
Yeah. Who knew it was such a hotbed of interest?
Yeah. I mean, when everything went up to $10 million with this rate of inflation for an estate tax, that most of us estate planners were like, hallelujah, that takes care of all of our clients practically, or a lot of them.
Yeah.
So we use trusts. And I'm sure, you know, Yana and I doing trusts in our respective states are doing a lot of planning because we know that that law, if nothing else is done in Congress, the current exemption is going to sunset down to 5 million. And so we have to build in our trusts some flexibility. So trusts allow us to do tax planning on death. It also, I think for one of my, for my clients, one of the biggest things that I think a trust does is it allows for planning, not just on death as who gets what and under what terms, but I think it also allows you to say, if I become incapacitated, this is who's in charge of my money, all these assets. And I usually make my trustee the same person as the power of attorney and the same person who's the executor. Those three roles are money managers, and it's always the same lineup for my clients. And if I have a client who says, I want my sister to be power of attorney and I want my brother to be executor. And I'm like, nope, you guys got to make a decision who the money manager is. But those people can take over your assets and manage them for you when you're incapacitated. And the trust provides a rule book about what the rules of engagement are. I mean, I was just reading a trust that somebody's brought to us and we're reviewing it because the daughter's taking over. One of the terms in it was if either of the people who created the trust, the settlors, become incapacitated and they're the surviving person, the successor trustee cannot disclose to any of the beneficiaries, the kids who are waiting in the wings, cannot disclose any of the financial information of the surviving parent until she's dead. And we're like, that is weird. So now we're wondering why, what was that all about? Well, then we flip over and each of the kids has been loaned different amounts of money over the years. And that's why mama doesn't want.
Deborah, did you freeze?
Any of the kids to know until she's dead. The trust also vehicle for me. Pardon?
Hold on.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. And I think, it provides, like Yana and Autumn mentioned, it provides you the flexibility to figure out how you're going to make distributions to children, to nieces and nephews. You can prioritize in a trust if I become incapacitated and I have multiple pieces of property and investments, you know, brokerage accounts. You can actually in your trust say, here's my list of priorities. So if I've run out of cash, I want you to sell this first. I want you to sell that first. I want you to keep the family cabin, you know, for people here in California where I'm at in Tahoe. I want that to be the very last thing that you ever sell to take care of me. So you can kind of prioritize things like that. A trust also is a really important vehicle if you have a blended family. You know, his and her kids, her and her kids, whatever the mix is, and you're coming together from prior relationships with different, you know, different groups of children, then we can talk about that and what we're going to do in the trust, because some people say, I want my surviving spouse to get everything. And my first question is, okay, everything, no holds barred. They can change the trust any way they want. If your kids act bad at the funeral, they can write them out. If the cabana boy shows up, they can give it all to them. So these are the, and I always say the cabana boy, because once I say that, if I have a husband and wife, male and female couple, and if I say that the cabana girl shows up, all of a sudden the wife is like, absolutely, that person gets locked up. He can never do that. And it changes the dynamics. So you want to keep the discussion open and flowing, but you have to, as a couple, you have to think that your partner, whether you're married or not, and you're doing, if you're doing a, you know, if you're domestic partners, the likelihood is your spouse or partner will have another companion after you die. You know, if you're short of 80, but even some of my 80-year-old clients, you know, are still getting another partner, living together in somebody's house. That's an important thing when you have a living trust is, and everything goes to the surviving partner or spouse. We want to have that discussion about what's going to happen with that primary residence when your new partner or companion decides to move in because you want to take care of each other later in life. How long do they get to live in the house after you die? How long do they get to stay in the house if you have to move out to a facility? What do they have to pay? You know, and some of the important things are, you know, you think about, well, they'll pay the mortgage. Well, once they start paying the mortgage, they get a percentage of ownership, even if they're not on title. They have an equitable share. And that's an important thing in California with married spouses too, is you say, well, I brought the condo into the marriage. Well, once your spouse starts paying part of that mortgage on that condo, they, even though they're not on title, they have an equitable share in that. And when you get separated or divorced, us lawyers get to fight about, you know, how to undo that. So
then, right, the lawyers. So part of doing this work is to prevent that. And I don't mean not get your fair share, because you do your work up front if you're doing the planning. But I just mean don't piss away the assets of the estate unintentionally. There's a bunch of questions I want to get to. We have about 15 more minutes, and I have a couple other things I want to cover in here. And I'll just go through a couple of considerations, just kind of summarize. If you have minor children, you should consider a trust if it makes sense for what you're doing. If you have real property, especially if it's in multiple states or in foreign countries, definitely consider what you're going to do with each of those things and whether a trust makes sense. Divorce and remarriage are other kind of milestone areas to address these concerns. I told you, Greg and I redid our documents, and then Karen and I did our documents. Like, he didn't have anything in place and he had significant assets. And so finally, he's put documents in place, but he hasn't funded the trust except for the one piece of property Debbie did the title change on. So we're having discussions about that. So, and you can ping him on that. Totally good with that, Deb. There are just so many considerations in here of how you want to protect your assets and what you want to happen on incapacitation or death. So incapacitation is much more likely to happen than straight out death. So I want you guys to take those considerations and think about those. And most important, if you have an LLC or a business or a corporation, or you have a private family foundation, or you have charities you want to leave money to, make sure that you're thinking about those things. And the last thing is, please, please, please leave a roadmap, whether it's a binder or a piece of paper somewhere that tells your family, if you haven't had these conversations, that tells your family where things are, what, you know, what to do. You know, I've now done this for three people, Greg's dad, my grandfather, and then Greg, where is everything? and thankfully it's led to me and my mom having the conversation of, here's where the password list is. Here's where the bank accounts are. Here's where the brokerage accounts are. Here's where the life insurance and other things are. So she put everything kind of on a binder and said, here are my documents, and shared those with me. Now, here's one thing she did. She put me on the bank account so that I'm here and can make changes in case incapacitation happens. My brother and I have a good enough relationship that that's not a concern for her, that we wouldn't end up in the situation that Deb mentioned about the siblings that now no longer talk to each other, because there's only one account to be on. So we can see where the money is going. So those are just the considerations that I want you guys to think about. Pick one of these three ladies, call them, talk to them, pick anyone on the resource list, but start that conversation with what you want and how you want to protect yourself. I do want to say one thing before we go to more of the questions directly, is that actually there's two more topics. One, costs are going to vary widely. You heard Yana say she charges by the hour. Autumn charges a flat fee. Deb charged by the hour, at least when we did it. I had another one that was a flat fee. So it's going to differ attorney to attorney and state to state. And I mean wildly in terms of cost to get these documents done. So don't be afraid to ask how much it costs and what does it cover? Because this is the last thing I wanted to say, is it's not a once and done thing. Don't leave it like I did for 25 years and not revisit it. do you still want your money going that way or your property or whatever? It is something to review regularly, especially, and I would say, and this is my own advice, visit it yearly or visit it on life events. So I mentioned the divorce and remarriage. I mentioned having children, buying a property. There's all kinds of milestones in there. If you guys want to chime in on other milestones or other considerations for those two things, otherwise I'll go on to
what I do is when I the day that I sit down with my clients and their witnesses and we sign and notarize everything, I put that date in my calendar, my Google calendar every year to remind me. And every year I'm going to email them and check in and say, hey, pull it out, look at it, see if we need to make any changes. But then I also do tell them, you know, if you get divorced, if you get married, if you have another kid, if you're moving to a different state, anytime something major happens, pull it out and look at it. But at a minimum, we're going to look at it every year.
Yeah. I would add to that, you know, if you are buying or selling real estate, if you are starting a business, if the way that, you know, the way that you're compensated changes, you go from being a W-2 employee to being a 1099 employee, a consultant, you know, just something to check up on. And we actually are in the process of setting up a more automated system. You know, we do what Autumn described, but we're going to start harassing our clients more regularly with emails, you know, kind of reminding them. And what we actually do is a few days a month, the team takes a few hours and we pick up the phone and call people and say, hey, what's going on? You know, talk to me, because sometimes it doesn't click in people's minds. And I'm not faulting anyone for this. And it takes someone kind of giving you space to say, hey, what's going on in your life? You know, we just want to make sure that everything is still in order and have there been any changes. And people start kind of searching their minds for, you know, what's going on. And then my paralegal might say, oh, you know, that's something that you might want to talk about with Yana. Should we get something on the books for a call with her? And I just wanted to quickly add, I know Deb addressed this, but I don't allow clients not to let me fund their trusts. You know, some people say, and I do typically charge flat fees for estate planning because we have a strategy session, we talk about our goals and what we're going to do, and then I set a fee. And some people will say, well, I'm just going to fund it myself. So can you reduce the fee? Because in my engagement letter, I lay out, we're going to do the advanced directives, we're going to do, you know, create the trust, we're going to fund the trust, we're going to transfer your real estate, you know, et cetera. But, you know, we want a discount. And I'm like, you can't, you're not, I don't do that. Because I have seen so many people walk into my office with these beautiful leather binders, and sometimes they even have their name and gold, you know, stamped on the front. And they're like, well, you know, dad has dementia now and he broke both legs and he's in the nursing home, but we're okay to apply for Medicaid, right? Because we made this trust. And then I say, well, let's look at the deed, and the deed is still in dad's name, you know, and the accounts are still in dad's name. So
driving me bananas.
That's a big no-no.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing I was also going to say is that one of the things that should cause you to review your estate plan is also looking at who your people are that you named and if their life changes. Yeah. If your brother moves to Thailand, he's not going to be your healthcare agent. He can't do it. He can't do it from there.
Yeah. The other thing, go ahead, Deb.
Oh, I was going to say, or their life, they've gotten divorced, or, you know, things have changed in their financial situation, their business has failed, and, you know, or just something that just causes you and or your partner to say, is this really the right person anymore? And I agree with Yana. I mean, when you're talking to an attorney, you want to be upfront. You want them to be upfront about how they charge. But then when it, like Yana was saying, I've had people who wanted to dicker with their the cost. And I'm like, do you go to your doctor and ask them if they'll reduce the fees if they do a few less x-rays? You're coming to an attorney versus doing it yourself. You can do it yourself and you can miss things, but you're coming to a person who's a professional who is, you're paying them to figure out what are the tax implications so that you can make decisions. What are the what ifs and putting together all of those things. And it has value. to you, and it and what they're selling is what's in their brain, and that has value on the marketplace. And so I think you definitely want to know how they bill upfront. You don't want any surprises so that you can budget. And that's what I tell my clients. This is how much I charge. You should budget this to this. And at our first conference, we'll discuss which, you know, if I think we're going to be on the low end, or because you have 10 pieces of property I have to put in your trust, you're going to be over that, you know, you're going to be outside that range because I have all those recording costs. And the attorney should be more than happy to tell you where the costs come from. You should expect to pay for phone calls that are substantive legal stuff. You should expect to pay for substantive emails. And I mean substantive, not like scheduling. I don't charge for putting you on my calendar. But, you know, where there's substantive legal discussions going on and correspondence, those are things that all attorneys charge for. Some of the add-ons will be, you know, copy costs, mailing costs. I personally don't include that. That's encompassed with me running my practice. And so I don't nickel and dime about those kinds of things. And the other thing, I am with Yana. If you have a trust, it needs to get funded. I put the real property in and I give you a to-do list on how to do it. And every time you come into my office to review your estate plan every 3 to 5 years or 10 years or whatever, I'm going to ask you to bring every single statement you have in, every single policy that you, insurance policy and IRA, I'm going to ask you to log on, and I'm going to ask you to print out who your beneficiaries are. And if you don't have that ability, I'm going to ask you to call your financial person and say, I want a letter sent to my house of who the beneficiaries are. We want all that in our file. And there's a lot of reasons why, but I'll cut it off at that.
We just started a Google Doc to be able to track some of that stuff, like between our things, because we're like, there's too many things to track. And it's like, I know we did it when we got married, and I know we did it when we put our trust and stuff in place, but now, like, where are they and what should they be? I do want to ask you guys, in terms of selecting an attorney, are there questions, and just give a quick answer, Yana, Deb, and then Autumn, of what do people coming to you not ask that they should in selecting an estate planning attorney?
Great question. So number one, I would ask, you know, what's the focus of their practice? Because I find with a few areas of law, and estate planning tends to be one of them, a lot of attorneys think, oh, writing a will, that's just easy. I'll just pick up a form and fill in the blanks. And those are really dangerous. I think they're worse than LegalZoom, because you think you're getting, you know, really competent advice. So I would ask, and if someone says, oh, well, I do matrimonial law and immigration law and criminal law and trusts and estates, I would probably suggest you find someone that focuses, you know, on that area. You know, ask them, you know, how long they have been practicing. And that doesn't necessarily make them a better attorney, but if they have been practicing a long time, you might want to ask them, do they have a mentor or a co-counsel or, you know, someone, you know, to discuss cases with? You can ask them sort of how involved they are in staying on top to developments in the law. You know, estate planning and property law is probably one of the oldest, you know, sections of law. But I find that a lot of the colleagues that I really respect and look up to are members of various committees with the Bar Association or, you know, things like that. You might want to ask, how easy is it to speak to you? You know, and one thing that I tell my clients is, if you call my office, I'm almost never going to be able to get on the phone with you, but my staff will be happy to schedule a call, you know, or Zoom or an appointment for you probably the next day, you know, but I'm almost never going to be able to do it right away. But I'm very upfront about that. I tell people that in the beginning, so I don't want them getting frustrated.
Right. You know, set that expectation.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that I put in the chat window that I think is important is
Do you have a rapport with that person? Do they answer your questions without making you feel stupid? And do they answer it in plain English? Or do they explain what, like, revocable trust? What does that actually mean in plain English? That is like what I look to when I'm looking for an expert is, do they know their stuff, which is what Yana said. Do they answer my questions? And I find this with men, and that they don't always answer the question and they make me feel like I'm stupid, which obviously I'm not, but they make you feel that way. So that's one of the things I look at. So Deb, what else do you look at? Or what do you think clients should ask you that they don't?
Well, I don't know what they should ask me that they don't, because I get asked a lot of questions and I'm okay with it. Yeah. But I think Yana hit on one of them is, you know, asking what their communication style is. How do they bill? You want to understand what that is. I would reemphasize, you know, how do you choose a good lawyer? So I think it's the same way that you choose a good, any good professional. You have to have a rapport. You have to be able to hear from the person with whom you're having this initial discussion that they're listening to you. That they are they hear your concerns and they're mirroring that back and answering your questions directly, especially when you're paying people by, you know, the hour or the minute, you know, not the minute, but in 6 minute segments or something. You want it to be, you want to be communicating with somebody that you understand and that are succinct. And I think that that's really important. I always encourage people when they're coming to do an estate plan, I want you to talk to your partners before you talk to me that first meeting about what your expectations are with each other. I think it's so important that you don't have that first discussion about what you think should happen on death in front of the lawyer and your spouse is going,
what do you mean?
You know, like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you have separate in California, you know, we have community property and separate property. So I ask clients who have ranches or have their houses that they brought, but that they had before marriage, or businesses or whatever they have, you know, you need to have a discussion about, you know, the ranch that you own with your family members. Is that going to go to your spouse or it's not? They need to know that before you get on the phone call or the Zoom call with me. Yeah. So those are kind of things I want them to do. And look at the resources. One of the great resources in California is a publisher in Berkeley called Nolo Press, N-O-L-O Press. And they just have great books on legal topics that give you it in plain speak. Now, I wouldn't say go do it and use their program. I don't know anything about their programs. But for me, like when I deal with special needs trusts sometimes with clients, I'll go in there, and if I need to describe something that's quite complex legally, I don't want to spend your money and my time, you know, vomiting on the table all this legal stuff. I want you to understand what I'm saying in plain English so that we can kind of get to those topics. And Nolo Press does a great job on that. And I think it's really important, like Yana said, you want to have somebody who practices in this area. This needs to be what they do. This is their bread and butter. One of the places you can go if you have no idea and you have no friends who can, you know, say, oh, you know, my friend went to this lawyer or that lawyer. If you don't have somebody, a resource like that, go to your county bar association online, and then you can look at who's, like we have sections like the civil section and the litigation section. Look at who the board members are in the probate section. And then it might have four or five people, like in our county, we have a big county. So there's a number of people, some counties it's only two people, but those are good people to start with. Cause if they're involved in their county bar and they're on the board for the probate section, and usually probate will cover all these topics. Remember, probate code covers all this. Those are good people to start with. The other organization that I belong to is the Estate Planning Council. And like I belong to Estate Planning Council of Diablo Valley, but I think they're a national organization. And who are the people that are part of that who are on the board there? So I'm always directing people, look for people who are involved in their community, are in a board position. It's not a guarantee that they're a great lawyer, but you know, usually if they weren't a great lawyer, their colleagues would be like, why are they on the board? You know, they're a schmo. So get them off of there. Yeah.
So do I need to pick somebody, for example, do I have to pick somebody who is where the assets are or where I am, or can I pick somebody in any state? How do I select somebody? Why not go to Kentucky and work with Autumn, who doesn't charge very much?
Well, we are only, you need to choose somebody in your state because we are licensed by the state.
Yeah.
So I cannot practice. Autumn cannot practice law for a California resident. I can't practice for somebody who's in New York.
But my mother died in California and I live in Oregon. So do I need to find somebody in California or somebody in Oregon?
Well, it depends on what the trust says or the estate. If your mother was a resident of California, then you need a California lawyer because it's going to be a California probate.
Oh, that's too bad. Okay. Got it.
Okay, Autumn, did you have one thing to add? We're gonna go over a couple minutes because I've got to share what I promised you for free, and I have a couple wrap-up comments as well. But Autumn, I wanna hear what you think people should ask you and don't.
Well, I think all of the bases have been covered. One thing I do wanna point out, and this may be a little controversial, but I know some estate attorneys will start with, when you call and make an appointment, they'll send you a 10-page questionnaire that they want you to fill out before you come in and sit down. I don't like to take that approach. I want to sit and have a 15 to 20 minute conversation with my clients first, where we just talk about like, what's the process? What are the different pieces, and get them thinking about it before we launch into that. So I think if you can find an attorney who's willing to do that, and better yet, not charge you for it, that's a good sign, because that's someone who is definitely interested in making sure that you are comfortable with the process. And it's not to ding people who charge for the consultations at all. But I mean, I am in Kentucky and I don't make a lot of money. So if I'm hiring an attorney, I want to talk to someone who's going to, you know, sit down with me for 15 minutes, not charge me, talk about the basics, let us see if we're a good fit for each other. Because it's not just me picking an attorney, it's the attorney picking me. You know, we can decide whether we want to take on a client, and it's got to be a good fit both ways. So I think if you can find attorneys that will take that opportunity, that's a good thing. And call three or four, ask them the same questions, ask them what they offer, what they charge, what their process is, because you might get a variety of answers just in your own town. And there may be one approach that just speaks to you or is more comfortable for you than another.
Just on that point, that Autumn, so I'm an attorney who does charge for the consultations, but I do take phone calls. When people are calling me and they're wanting to have initial discussion, am I going to need to have a probate? So I will take a few minutes and talk in a lot of minutes probably, and I will talk to initial clients, but I don't do free consultations just because this is how I make my living. And if I take three free consultations a day, that's a significant, you know, amount of money or a week. So, and I do send out the worksheet ahead of time because I want you to fill it out. And then I want to see it beforehand because I'm very aware, you know, and like Autumn said, we all do it differently, but I'm very aware that my time is your money. So I don't want to have the first meeting unprepared. If you have existing documents that you want to amend, I don't want to sit in front of you reading them and you paying me to do that. That is not fair to you. And it's not a good use of my time because there are things that I might miss because I'm sitting in front of you reading and I am trying to do it quickly. So I like to see all that information ahead of time so that when we do have the first consultation and we're talking about the estate plan, you know, I'm going through your worksheet and saying, what about this? Oh, what about that? You know, and I'm looking at, you've marked that you have a special needs child. And so I'm going to make sure we talk about that. So it's different for each attorney. But I agree with Autumn, you want to know that ahead of time.
And I do a hybrid. I don't send out a very long worksheet. I have 5 open-ended questions. But I do charge for my consultations. We call them strategy sessions. What I do offer my clients is I have a staff that I'm really proud of. And they do free calls with our client, with our potential clients. And for a few reasons, one, I don't want you to pay me money if I can't help you, you know, and sometimes they slip by and I will always refund their consultation fee because that's not how I want to make money. And they kind of go through the questions and make sure they understand the assets and the facts. So I can review that ahead of time. And when we have our call, I want to hear you talk about really what your goals are. Because I think sometimes clients get stressed out that they can't clearly explain what type of trust they want to have. Like that's my job. You know, you tell me that I want to make sure that, you know, my children are able to benefit from, you know, the money that I leave behind and that the music school that has been a huge part of our life, you know, gets something, you know, if they don't or, you know, whatever it is, you tell me, you know, tell me your goals and I will help you figure out a way to get there.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I want to wrap up and I want to say I really appreciate Yana and Deb and Autumn for joining me to have this important discussion for everybody. It's one of the areas that keeps coming up with clients and like I said, it's not an area I want to delve into. And I really appreciate you making yourselves available and sharing your expertise today. I put the contact information not only in the chat window, but I put the link to the website page that I put together just to capture all this information. It's on soniasigler.com/estate-planning-basics. I put it in the chat window so you guys can see it. And I'll post the recording there. And the resource list of attorneys in other states is posted there as well. And then we had a ton of questions we didn't get to about multiple generation families and stuff. And so if you guys want to hang out when I, in a few minutes, we can maybe answer a few of those questions for people that want to hang on. But I'm going to stop recording and I just want to say thank you very much. I really appreciate it.